Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi. My name is Nathan Hobson, and I'm a host for the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast, a member of the New Books Network. Today, I'm going to be talking with Robert Hellier about his book, Green with Milk and Sugar, When Japan Filled America's Teacups, out from Columbia University Press in 2021. Green with Milk and Sugar is a tale of American and Japanese teaways, skillfully weaving together stories of Midwesterners drinking green tea, the recent and complex origins of the Japanese love of now ubiquitous sencha, Ceylon tea merchants exploiting American racism, Chinese tea production expertise, and the author's own family history in the Japan-America tea trade, going back to the 19th century. Transnational histories and commodity histories are notoriously delicate dances, but Hellier has produced a very readable and eye-opening look at the modern history and culture of tea. Green with Milk and Sugar will be of interest to a diverse group of historians, scholars of North America, East Asia, commerce and trade, economics, food, etc., but also to a general audience who will be pulled in by the author's personal connections as well as the delightfully jargon-free narrative. Okay, so Dr. Hellier, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. So I wanted to start out with the question that we ask everybody, which is, how did you become interested in the project that became Green with Milk and Sugar?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me, and please call me Robert. And there are two major things that brought me to be interested in this project. First of all was my family. My ancestors went to Japan on my father's side in the 1850s. And became involved in exporting tea to the United States. So hearing about this growing up, particularly from my paternal grandmother, led me to want to study this in more detail. And second was that as a historian, I thought there was a fabulous story here, particularly about the idea of Americans and Americans in the Midwest drinking Japanese green tea. So I really wanted to dig deeper about that and learn about that. So those are the two big motivations for me to write this book.
Great. And that actually transitions us really nicely into the two things that I wanted to ask you about in the introduction, right? So just for our audience, your book is this historical look at American tea consumption, tea ways, as you put it, and the domestic and international contexts of tea way development in the United States. And those two things which you mentioned immediately piqued my interest. So the first is your argument that Americans who now drink black teas were once so keen to have their teas green that they willingly bought them with additives that enhanced a tea's green color. And I'm quoting from you here. But and then you continue, Japanese today overwhelmingly drink green teas that, when infused, produce a rich green brew. Yet in the past, a good portion of Japanese consumed green teas that yielded a brown nectar when brewed. So this sort of reversal in tea brewing and culture and so on and so forth was really sort of fascinating to me. And as somebody who's interested in food history as well, I was also a little embarrassed that I didn't know this. And then the second thing is the thing that you mentioned first, which is your own family's intimate connection to this history. So I wonder if you could start out by telling us a little more about both of these things, the surprising trajectory of American tea drinking on the one hand, and the role that your family played in that history. And more specifically, if you could talk about how Americans, especially in the Midwest, started out the 19th century with a preference for green tea, often consumed hot with milk and sugar, which is how we get the title of the book. If that's the case, then when and why did that change in sort of the broadest strokes? And how does your family history fit into that story? How are the two integrated?
Well, thank you for all the questions. I'll start first by explaining a little bit about my family background. As I mentioned, dated back to the 1850s, and a man named William Ault, who was my great uncle five generations back, at the age of 13, he left Britain seeking to help his family financially. And he worked on the crew of a merchant ship that traded around the world, including taking tea from Shanghai to Britain. And in 1858, he accepted a job in Shanghai, and the following year went to Nagasaki to seek more opportunity. He founded in Nagasaki what we might call today an import-export firm, and quickly developed tea exports. And what was very interesting to me, among many things, was how that Ault made a decision, like other British merchants in Nagasaki at the time, to sell teas, Japanese teas, to the United States, to the U.S. market. And Ault retired around his 30th birthday, having made his fortune, returned to England. And my great-great-grandfather, Frederick Hellyer, took over the company and began to focus exclusively on tea exports. And because increasingly as the 19th century went on, that the Midwest was the center of the U.S. tea market, Frederick moved his family to Chicago in 1888. So in a lot of ways, on my father's side of the family, became Americans because of green tea's popularity in the United States. So that's a bit of a background on my family. The other point that you made, surprising about Americans drinking tea and drinking green tea, I was also certainly surprised when I found out about this initially. But I think one thing that it leads to is that there is, first, we are surprised, I guess we being a lot of times what's been accepted both in scholarship and in popular discourse, that there could be a distinct American culture. It's often dismissed. An American tea culture is often dismissed. And thankfully, we're moving away from an idea that was developed, certainly in the 19th century, that Americans had patriotically given up tea and embraced coffee with the Boston Tea Party in 1773. And also in a lot of scholarship on tea, there's a sense that even after independence, those Americans that are drinking tea are Anglophiles who have a connection to Britain, and the British tea culture is therefore influencing what's happening in the United States. But one of the things that I hope can be a takeaway from the book is how important, first of all, the direct link that the United States had with China and how that led to a distinct tea culture or tea ways, as I like to call it, in the United States, particularly from 1800, when U.S. ships started to bring more green tea and was able to sell it in the United States at a higher price than black teas, that leads then to the start of the U.S. preference for green tea. Also, we don't have a distinct American practice of tea drinking. Americans had tea parties that were modeled on the British style, but there was no ritual about how to drink it. So therefore, one of the really striking aspects, and of course, that is the title of the book, was how many Americans would decide with their green tea that they wanted to drink it hot with milk and sugar. So perhaps you wanted me to go in, those are two directions. Would you like me then to talk now more about then the switch?
Please, that would American be great. Yes, thank you.
Okay, sure. Well, a background about that was that we have from the 1850s is a real growth of American tea consumption. Americans are drinking a lot more. At that point, the teas are all from China. But there is then a real divergence from first of all, from the 1860s, when we have then the change, an important change in the world tea market.
Okay, so the second half of the 19th century, you really show that this was revolutionary for American tea. So first, Americans began drinking a lot more tea. And that was both oolongs and more of the sort of English breakfast teas that a lot of people think of these days when we think of black tea. And you relate this to the history between the U.S., Japan, the British Empire, and China at the time. And while China was still the monopoly producer of tea, that situation was changing in the 1860s. So both the U.S. and Japan are engaged in civil wars at the time in the 1860s. But even so, America began to welcome Japanese green tea, which had some really profound effects for both countries. So can you tell us about the changes in the world of tea that begin really in the middle of the 19th century and into the 1860s? And also the place of domestic Japanese brokers such as Oura Kei, and also William Ault, your ancestor who you mentioned, and the emergence and the innovations. I was fascinated by the mail order brand marketing, for example, of the great American tea company at this time.
Well, thank you very much for those questions. We can make an important change starting just around 1860. And that comes first with Japan being the first country to challenge China's long-held monopoly on the world tea market. This being the only country that is supplying tea to the outside world, particularly the Western world, was China up to this point. So Japan exporting for this time is very significant. And that's followed from the 1870s by dramatic increases in production, first in India and Ceylon. The fact that tea had not been produced in those areas up to this point. And there's wonderful stories, books written about how the British were able to develop that production and also then change the British market that in 1860 was predominantly Britons consuming Chinese tea. 15 years later, that has changed to Indian and the later Ceylon tea. So that's the background of what's changing so dramatically in the world tea market. And so when Japan is entering it, it's also entering the United States that we see from the 1860s is involved in a lot of market innovations. As you mentioned, one of the things was the Great American Tea Company that had, number one, developing mail order sales. And the idea that a consumer could be buying direct from the importer. This was an exaggeration in a lot of ways of what Great America was doing. But nonetheless, it was a very, very effective marketing scheme. And also, one of the intriguing things is that Great American and other American tea companies based in New York at this time in the 1860s coin the phrase Japan tea, which becomes then the brand name for Japanese tea until really the 1940s. So also what's happening in some of the points that you mentioned is later on in the 19th century that there's a really dramatic regionalization of tea consumption. We have other innovations that are happening. Tea producers in New York are also inventing the term English breakfast tea. It was a way to dress up, if you will, a lower grade of Chinese black tea. And this is stuck. And of course, we can buy English breakfast tea at many stores around the world, I think. But it is a decidedly an American invention. And also with the regionalization, oolong tea is consumed in New York. And more of the first black teas that are coming in from India and Ceylon are consumed on the eastern seaboard. So to come back to your question then about Japan, in the 1860s, of course, we're seeing the path toward the Meiji Restoration. The fact that in 1859, Japan had opened three ports to Western-style free trade. And tea, being the second largest export of Japan throughout most of the Meiji period after silk, offers tremendous opportunities for people, as you mentioned, Oda Kay, who is an amazing figure as being a successful businesswoman in Nagasaki in the 1860s and 1870s, who served as a broker of selling tea to Western export firms. And so she is connecting to people like William Ault that I mentioned, is who is coming to Nagasaki to sell his, as I mentioned, to set up his firm. So there's all kinds of really intriguing international connections that are developing here in the 1860s. And as you say here, that shows us how much then tea and the tea market overall is changing in that period.
Yes, and the other thing that you really get into beyond this sort of history of tea as a commodity and these sort of economic connections that are being made and the sort of internal economics of, you know, building new markets and creating new products is this idea of the interplay of American and Japanese tea ways. And this, particularly the sort of factors such as the American shift to black teas in the 1920s, which make sencha, the green tea, the most widely consumed in Japan, drunk from morning until night. And so we have green tea, both from China and Japan, as a sort of completely mundane, ordinary part of American life throughout these latter years of the 19th century and into the 20th. And it seems to me you're suggesting that changes then in American tea consumption feed back in the 20th century profoundly to Japanese tea drinking. So there's this interplay of tea ways.
Sure, yes. And maybe to explain what happens in Japan in the 1920s, I should add a little bit more background in the late 19th, early 20th century in the United States. And as I mentioned, that the Midwest becomes, as I call it, green tea country. And this really emerges from the 1880s. And I think what is going on here is, first of all, that Midwesterners, here's a place that is growing tremendously, new cities emerging. And as a way to show the sophistication of Midwesterners, they appropriate what has been the established American tea way since 1800, and that's consuming green tea. And so green tea becomes popular, I think, because of this. It's also the fact that Midwesterners, like other Americans, are really fascinated and focused on the tea as it looks at the store when they purchase it. So having a tea that is green as it's in a color that you can see when you put it in the bag, when the grocer puts it in the bag for you, was very, very important. And so we're seeing in the Midwest at this time that green tea is actually being democratized, as I call it. A wider swath of consumption, people in cities in the Midwest, but also Midwestern farmers that are consuming a lot more tea. So the long and short of it, there's increasing imports into the United States in the late 19th and then into the early 20th century. What happens then in the late 19th century, actually from the 1890s, is that India and Ceylon producers who'd been very, very successful in capturing the British and other, British imperial markets, turn their focus on to the United States. And they're hoping then to sell their black teas in the United States. And what they develop is a very coordinated advertising campaign, a negative campaign, where they put an idea of where green tea, and this is both Japanese and Chinese green teas, as being dangerous, dirty, and fraudulent. And many times are using in many of their advertisements, are using images that are racist, that show then a Japanese or Chinese coolie. And the implication is that this dirty coolie who is processing the tea, oftentimes without any kind of limited clothing, that their sweat is getting into the teas and changing the flavor. So what this negative campaign does is it plants the seed then for many Americans to begin to question green tea. And this change that we see in the United States to, as you mentioned, asked earlier, about when do Americans start to embrace black teas, is starting actually in the 1920s. It probably could have started in World War I, but because of disruptions from the war, the teas that were being produced in India and Ceylon were not being exported to Britain, other colonial markets. So therefore, Japan had a real opportunity and was selling a tremendous amount of teas around the world. So as I hope I'm bringing together all these points of, you know, one thing that's going on in the United States, another thing that's going on in Japan, this convergence that it happens in the 1920s, that here is Japan producing record amounts. 1917 is really one of the record years of Japanese production. But in the 1920s, the convergence of in the United States, where many Americans start to question green teas, start to see more advertisements for black teas, and therefore turn to buying black teas. What this leads to then is a glut of tea in Japan, a glut of the sencha, of which Japanese had been exporting and making very handsome profits in this export. But the Japanese producers are left with the question of what to do, with all this glut of tea. So here we have, for the first time in a lot of ways since the start of this export trade and this growth of this production, is that Japanese producers are focused on selling in the domestic market. And what they want to do is to market sencha and be able to sell it to Japanese consumers. So what they develop is, first of all, a pretty significant advertising campaigns, and then also start to present Japanese green tea, particularly sencha, as being healthy and being high in vitamin C. So this is the important change that is happening in starting in the 1920s and really extending to today. So the 1920s, I keep bringing it up, is the pivotal turning point in this story because of what first happens, the changes in the United States that lead, therefore, to changes in Japan.
Yeah, and I find this very interesting because it's coming, it's coming along with the first major waves of anti-Asian racism, specifically Chinese and then Japanese, in the U.S. at the beginning of the 20th century. And that's sort of also accelerating at the same time that we're seeing this negative advertising by the promoters of Ceylon and other black teas. And so this element of racism, and as you mentioned, the sort of image of the dirty coolie sweating all over your tea, sort of that sort of pernicious image manipulation goes along with the really interesting to me story of a gentleman named Vincent Tissera, who is one of the marketers of the Ceylon teas, who's profiting from, right, quite literally, this racism at the same time that he's experiencing American racism himself.
Yes, absolutely. Tissera was somebody that I discovered in doing my research, and I felt very important to include his story, although he wasn't somebody involved in importing Japanese green teas. But he was intriguing, first of all, because he was a man who, a lot of ways, believed in the American dream and his idea that he could come to America, develop a company. He had these goals to sell Ceylon-produced tea in the United States, do direct imports along the lines of some of the things that I talked about. And I found in newspapers clear accounts of how he was subjected to many accounts of just outright racism in so many times of his life. But he was also then using playing up these images of Japanese green teas or Chinese green teas as being dirty, dangerous, and fraudulent. And so therefore, it would be better to purchase this India and Ceylon black teas, which was often Many advertisements were used, which were described that Americans should purchase this Indian Ceylon black teas because it is produced under white supervision. And so therefore it makes it a better product than the suspicious teas that are produced by Chinese and Japanese producers.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and this is what was interesting because, of course, you know, he's a native of, was it Colombo, I guess?
Yes.
And so my sense was, and I don't know if you can answer this, but he was experiencing a slightly different form of American racism as somebody with who wasn't sort of East Asian looking.
Yes. I haven't, in doing the book, I didn't have a chance to research more, particularly about people from South Asia in the United States in this period that I imagine were forced to endure these same kinds of racism. But yes, he is a very, very interesting individual because of how he is forced to overcome racism, and also the fact that around this time there are, for example, a tea board that is set up by the U.S. federal government that is to assure standards of tea. And the men, it's only men that are chosen on this board, are white men who are the what we call the larger tea importing exporting firms. And Tessera, to my knowledge, is never given the opportunity to be on this tea board. So he is constantly challenged to bring some success to his company.
Yeah. So and thank you for elaborating on that. Because as you point out, I mean, it's not precisely the core of your story, but it's also a very interesting part of the interwoven nature of all these different, you know, threads that you're bringing together, where you have Japan, you have China, you have the British Empire, you have American racism, you have American consumers, you have white people, you have green tea, you have black tea. And so I think it's important to understand that the book really does bring all these things together in, you know, what is in some ways, you know, a commodity history, right? But there's also this, it's not all racism. And so I want to look at some of the less disturbing parts of the book as well. And one of them is there's a section in the book which has this absolutely fantastic title, Chinese Style Japanese Green Tea for Americans. And I think if you could unpack that for us, it really gets to the core of what you're arguing in the book.
Well, thank you for the question. And then also just to build on your previous comment, the larger goal that I hope can be a takeaway from the book is that thinking about national history as being inherently international. And the title that it came to of Chinese Style Japanese Green Tea for Americans was learning about from the 1860s, which we talked about earlier as a takeoff point for Japan's tea exports, is the fact that the Westerners like William Ault, who were setting up tea factories in Nagasaki, he was hiring Japanese to work in them. Neither of those groups had any idea about how to produce tea on an industrial scale for export. Therefore, they turned to the people with the know-how, and these were Chinese experts. So one of the many intriguing aspects of this research is finding out of seeing, and I include a picture in the book, of a American export firm, and it's as late as around 1910, where they have an image of the skilled staff that is in the company. Are there by their clothing, by their hats, they're indicated to be in this image of about 20 men, 90% being Chinese. So the Chinese have this really, really important role of setting up how the tea, what type of tea is going to be exported in these plants. They therefore do what they've been doing back in China and producing a type of tea that was fired, and the term was called, it was subjected to heat over an extended period, usually about 30 to 40 minutes to eliminate moisture from the tea. They did this because it would prevent the tea from being moldy when it was opened up after being transported across the Pacific to the United States. This was the established way to refine it and ensure that it'll get to market. So this was the type of tea that was first produced for export in China and therefore then is produced in Japan. So the type of sencha, as we think of it today, that is being exported from Japan is really only starting in the first decade of the 20th century. Why? Because this is the first time you have real sort of mechanization in the factories in the Japanese port cities that allow then to have a tea that can be processed and maintain more of the original green color. But before this point, there was then using the Chinese method. And actually, some very interesting discussions I found, you know, for example, by Japanese officials in the 1890s and stuff, that they were saying, we have to move away from producing this, or to say exporting this Chinese style of tea. We have to export our own tea, which is better. We have pride in our own tea in this style. So it's intriguing to see how Japan, in its first few decades of its export regime, is exporting mainly what can be called here this Chinese style Japanese green tea.
Yeah, and you've actually touched on one other thing, which I just wanted to sort of bookmark here for our readers and listeners, which is that there's some really interesting sort of technical discussion of how the teas were made and the different grades of tea. And I found that to, as somebody who's interested in food, I found that to be quite intriguing, and I learned a lot from that as well. One of the things that you mentioned early on is that Japanese green tea was really most, popular, and these American green tea ways developed in the burgeoning Midwest. And it's also true, as you point out, that Japanese green tea held on after World War I longest in the Midwest, even as black tea was sort of pushing it out in other regions through the efforts of Tisera and the other Ceylon marketers that we've talked about. So you mentioned that you mentioned some of the reasons that green tea was popular in the Midwest. But can you speculate as to why it is that it was able to sort of hold on even as black tea was on the rise in other regions of the U.S. after the 1920s?
Sure. Yes, and thank you for that question. As I mentioned, just to build on, I think it's important to emphasize again about how that the Midwest was holding on to what was the established American tea way of drinking green tea. So I think that that was hard to move away from, number one, but also the fact that the groups, or I should say the within the market, who is really marketing black tea, are these large firms such as Lipton that we know about throughout the world today. But that marketing has a bit slower time of developing in the Midwest. And the reasons for this, I think, first of all, is that people are still buying in the Midwest a tea from, for example, the delivery man And I focus on one tea company in the U.S., Jewel Tea Company, that up until the 1920s was delivering by wagons that would go door to door and be selling to the families their staples, selling their brand of tea, and still selling a lot of Japanese green tea. They, of course, wanted to diversify. They could sell whatever they were trying to sell, whatever they wanted to, so would sell black teas as well. But the fact that it is very hard, I think, to quickly change the market in the Midwest is due to the fact that there's still the purchasing practices of so many Midwesterners, that they're still, understandably, using this way that they've been doing for decades of buying from this delivery person, delivery man, invariably was the case in this respect. So I think that those are two of the main reasons why the Midwest held out to be green tea country longer than other parts of the country.
Yeah, and I one of the reasons I wanted to ask about that is because I think that, you know, as a commodity history and a transnational history and a food history, you know, one of the interesting things beyond the sort of international contexts that we've talked about is that because it's a commodity history, there's also the, in addition to the people, in addition to the capital, in addition to the product, there's also the technologies of production, which we just were talking about a little bit, and then there's the infrastructure. And so this for me was also sort of a fascinating and revealing, I think, aspect of the history, was thinking about the speed of diffusion and how that relates to the sort of built environment, the material culture, the physical space, the infrastructure of not just production, but also distribution, and how that, you know, plays out in the consumer choices or what appear to be consumer choices and, you know, are actually quite constrained that are being made. So we've been talking a lot about the 1920s and, you know, also there's the starting with that first turning point in the 1860s, then the second turning point in the 1920s. And I guess the most obvious third turning point in your narrative has to be World War II, you know, which has a tremendous impact on the American thirst for Japanese tea. The export industry doesn't really recover for decades, as you point out in the book. And when it does, green tea emerges, or I guess reemerges, as this healthy special drink, rather than as a fixture of American life, which it had been a century earlier. So I guess in a way it's combining the marketing of sencha as healthy in the 1920s in Japan and the sort of specialness of the drink, which is something a little bit different than what it was in either country before that. And what accounts for that result, right, for the transformation in the American market? And how was that different from the way that the history of tea drinking and tea ways played out after 1945 in Japan?
Well, first of all, absolutely, that the World War II ended the exports, and the Japanese export trade really never recovered, and certainly was never achieved the same amounts of exports that it did, for example, in those peak times in during World War I. And we have, though, in the 1930s, many Japanese tea sellers that are working in the United States to try and sell more tea based upon the idea that it's healthy, that it's good for Americans. And it never takes off. It's successful, that marketing campaign, successful in Japan, but never successful in the United States. So I mentioned in the book that if the men that were involved with this in the United States in the 1920s and 30s, if they'd been around in the 1980s, they'd be bemused by the fact that their whole campaign would have achieved success in the 1980s, starting off of where we see then a return of interest in Japanese green tea in general, as a health product. And I think that this is also related to the fact in the 1980s that Japan becomes much more on Americans' radar because of the growth of the Japanese economy and Japan's greater international presence overall.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And I think that, reemergence of Japan, and a kind of, in a way, it struck me that it's part of a particular kind of Japanese chic that comes with that, that later on becomes, soft power and coup de Japan and some of the other things that we talk about, but that there's a sort of, not exactly precursor, but that it falls into some of those same categories as a cultural product, not just a food product in that sense. And I found that a very interesting sort of way to wrap up thinking about the book, which is what I'd like to start doing here. By first of all, thanking you for taking the time to talk about the book with us today. And also, asking you what you're up to now that you have your book out. What is it that you're working on? What can we expect to see from you in the future?
Well, thank you. First of all, about wrapping up the book, and in those last chapter, one of the things that was really fun for me that I was able to come back, talk a little bit about my adopted home state and adopted area of the American South. I live in North Carolina. I'm originally from Washington State and the west coast of the U.S. But coming here to the South, the American South, one of the big cultures is sweet tea. It's an icon of Southern food. And I was intrigued about how this iconic position developed of sweet tea, and learning about that, for example, that there was, there is a lot of focus on tea production in South Carolina, going back to the 19th century, and how that there's many arguing that this is really the important way of tracing American teaways, that we can think of it as particularly a domestic development, that the imports from China, from Japan, from India, from Ceylon aren't as important. So I really wanted to challenge that viewpoint and to come back to my larger point about the book, of where I wanted to emphasize about how national history is inherently international. And I saw this story about sweet tea as being a way to think about that, to revisit it and tie up the American story. And then also, as I think we mentioned, about how tea becomes then in the United States being much more of a health product as a way of tying up then that end of the story. Thank you also for asking then about my future research. One of the things that I'd like to do is to come back to a project that has some connections to the tea trade, but looking at the Pacific Ocean in the 18th and 19th centuries, particularly about, of course, Japan's place in it. And one of the things that's been intriguing to me was the accounts of Japanese castaways who, because of the way the Pacific Ocean and the currents play out, that so many Japanese were tragically sent as castaways by the ocean currents around different parts of the Pacific. And their accounts, therefore, form a very, very interesting source for us to look at the Pacific Ocean in the 18th and early 19th centuries. Heretofore, many of the accounts are usually from Europeans or from Americans or others, whether they be people like Captain Cook and the like. So I'm hoping to be able to develop some different ideas about how we can understand the Pacific through these accounts of Japanese castaways.
Well, that sounds fascinating. And I hope that in the not too distant future, we'll be able to get you back on the podcast with a follow-up book, of this time taking on the entire Pacific through the eyes of stowaways, castaways, excuse me. But that sounds wonderful, and I look forward to hearing more about the project as it develops. So thank you again for spending some time with us today and talking about your book.
Thank you very much for hosting me. It was a real pleasure.